wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. This is listener-supported community radio. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. That's PUGSPDX.com. And it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this June 25th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. In a two-part interview this morning, Bill Resnick talks with economist Jack Rasmus about Trump's trade theatrics, its stated and real goals, and how the overall Trump program could crash and burn in economic crisis. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews Weike Wang's short novel, Chemistry. Wang received a degree in chemistry from Harvard, where she also earned a PhD in public health. Her novel explores women in the sciences. And notorious misogynist Jordan Peterson will be speaking in Portland tonight. That's tonight, Monday, June 25th. And our old mole Fran Michelle comments on his controversial work and provides details about the protest, which is co-sponsored by Portland Socialist Alternative and Portland DSA. That all coming up this morning. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now it's time for Bill Resnick and Jack Rasmus.
Jack Rasmus, welcome to KBOO.
My pleasure.
Jack Rasmus teaches at St. Mary's College. He was the economics advisor to the Green Party presidential candidacy of Jill Stein. He blogs. He writes books. His books include Systemic Fragility and the Global Economy, and more recently, Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression. Recently, he wrote a three-part series of articles on the Trump administration. The first of the series was titled Trump's Phony Trade Wars. It appeared in Z Magazine. Jack Rasmus, tell us why all the sound and fury over the last several weeks or months on trade. Why is it phony, except maybe for China? But what's really happening?
Well, the U.S. is pursuing a two-track trade policy. One track is with China, and the motives are quite different than the separate track with U.S. allies and trading partners, you know, the NAFTA, Mexico, Canada, South Korea, Europe, and so forth. Why it's a phony trade war, I say, with the latter, with the allies, is that Trump is really attempting to renegotiate the existing deals. Most of those deals have been in place for quite some time, free trade agreements and so forth. He simply wants to put his stamp on those before the November elections. You see, a lot of this has to do with domestic politics and Trump playing to his political base with this economic nationalism theme and America First, which did so well for him in the 2016 elections. In fact, you can argue that, as I have and wrote, that kind of put him over the top in certain states. His promises to do something about these foreigners, not just the immigrants, but the capitalist foreigners who were competing, and he wants to get a better deal for his heartland economy and domestic political base. And a lot of it has to do with that right now. You know, with the allies, it's more smoke than fire.
You pointed out, though, that it's smoke and mirrors. With the allies, you pointed out the Korean trade deal. It was just a few relatively meaningless changes around the edges that then he could sort of promote. He did a trade deal. He finally did a deal as one of the historic events in the human experience.
Well, you know, he launches his trade wars here in March with the steel and aluminum tariffs. South Korea happened to be the second or third largest exporter of steel to the United States. And he cuts a deal then with South Korea that just tweaks the existing free trade agreement with South Korea and totally allows South Korea to continue its steel exports to the United States. It was a real softball deal. If you look at it, all it was some token adjustments to auto and truck quotas to the United States, and there really no tariffs at all on steel for South Korea. But yet he, as you say, comes off and with all his bombast and hyperbole and so forth, and lies, misrepresentation, says, well, this is a great deal. Well, it was a softball deal. That's the template. South Korea is the template for the rest, for the NAFTA negotiations, for the Europe negotiations. You know, the U.S. negotiators almost had a deal here a month or so ago on NAFTA with Mexico and Canada, but Trump intervened and blew up that deal at the very last minute, because he does not want a settlement on this deal or with Europe until he gets closer to the November elections or until the Mueller indictment comes down. What he's doing is mobilizing and agitating his political domestic base as part of the defense against the Mueller indictment and so forth when it comes down, or when he fires Mueller, which I predict he's going to do, and the November elections, which are very important, because if the Republicans lose the House, you might find some efforts to impeach him. So November is very important to him, and he's using the same strategy, political strategy he used in 2016, this economic nationalism, to agitate his base. And that's how you have to see not only all this smoke and mirrors about the trade wars, but also his immigration policy domestically. That's part of all this. If you look at NAFTA now, he said that he's not going to agree to this and so forth. He's reopened the NAFTA thing. And what's the response of Mexico and Canada to this, and the Europeans? Very, very timid, very token. I think they kind of know that this is more smoke than fire. Mexico has come back with less than $2 billion of counter tariffs. Europe, $3 billion. That's minuscule. That's nothing. That's not a trade war. None of these tariffs have really even taken effect yet. And if they do, there's so minimal with regard to the allies' trade war that it's just a lot of phony maneuvering, I believe.
Jack, let's talk about Europe, though, for a second. My sense is that he really does want to force the Europeans to continue to boycott Iran and not trade with them in order to weaken Iran in their struggle in the Middle East. I think he's serious about that, and he's using the trade war partly as a cudgel, because their economies are weak in Europe now and troubled, as a cudgel to force them to not trade with Iran.
Well, that's part of it, and what you're saying is there's political objectives behind the so-called economic trade war in Europe, and I would agree with you there, not just Iran. Trump is irked with Angela Merkel. He's not getting Angela Merkel and the Germans to really cooperate with him, not just on the Iran thing, but the Germans wouldn't go along with bombing Syria, and the Germans won't go along with ending the imports of Russian gas. And the U.S. wants to sell Europe its gas instead of having the Russians sell them gas. And there's a lot of other political issues. It's really Germany and Merkel that he's really pissed off with. This trade thing is really about that over there, I think.
Yeah. Jack, tell us about China. That's a different story.
Well, yeah, China's a different story. The U.S. really started preparing the trade war with China last August 2017. Trump told his trade representative and the trade agency, the USTR, to develop a justification for a trade war with China, and that was released in March. You see, the USTR came out with its report in March and indicted pretty much China and focused almost totally on this issue. The issue was technology transfer. The U.S. is increasingly concerned, particularly the defense intelligence establishment, with the progress China has made on the next generation technologies, meaning 5G wireless, artificial intelligence, and cybersecurity. These new technologies are going to allow whoever develops them first to take a quantum leap in terms of military capabilities. The U.S. military and intelligence are increasingly concerned that China is requiring U.S. companies in China to transfer their technology and China is investing in buying companies in the U.S. for their technology leverage. They, the U.S., wants to stop that. This technology transfer is one of the three essential objectives of U.S. trade negotiations with China, and it's going to be the most difficult objective. The other objective is, led by U.S. bankers and multinational companies, is that they want more access to China, China markets and China companies. Up to now, China has had a rule that you cannot buy more than 49% of their companies. The U.S. wants 51% or 100%, particularly the bankers, you see, because the bankers will finance all of these acquisitions over there. And so that's another faction in the U.S. trade negotiations want. The third faction simply wants China to buy more U.S. goods, particularly from the heartland, especially agricultural goods. So there's three factions in the U.S. negotiations, and they all went over there to Beijing, and the faction led by the bankers was given the lead. That's Steve Mnuchin, who's an ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs, running the Treasury Department now. He led the whole trade team. The hardliners, those who want tech transfer stopped, were represented by Lighthizer, Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, and Peter Navarro, this ultra-right wing behind the scenes, kind of like Bolton and Miller, right? They want to stop the technology transfer. He's allied with the Pentagon. And then, of course, Larry Kudlow, who represents the political objective of let's get the Chinese to buy more goods from the heartland, particularly agricultural goods, which will allow Trump to say, hey, look what I did for you guys here. So you got these three groups, and out of the trip to Beijing, Mnuchin came out on top. He's running the show, and he got rid of Navarro from the trade team. Well, Navarro and now the military have been working their way back through, trying to regain influence through Congress and through Bolton and the others. And they're having some success now. The fight is centered over this Chinese company, ZTE, and you get this pushback. We got to push more for the tech transfer issue back into negotiations. That's coming out of Congress, you see. And Trump is responding to it now. He's talking about it more, that's important. So you got this dissent in the U.S. negotiations going on. China has cleverly already responded to two of the factions. It's already said you can buy 51%, even we'll talk about 100% of our company. So they're appealing to the U.S. bankers and Mnuchin. And they also signaled, well, we'll buy $70 billion more of your agricultural goods, but they will not bend on the tech transfer issue, you see. If the trade war occurs, really erupts with China, and, you know, there are signs that they're moving in that direction, even though sometimes they move back. It will be over the tech transfer military implications issue here. See how it turns out. But that's like a more fundamental difference between China and U.S. than you see with Europe and NAFTA and South Korea and so forth. That will finish at the end of the midterm elections. That will be resolved right before or right after, you know, the allies, the second track. But the Chinese track will not be resolved very easily very soon.
It seems to me there's one other issue that's really important and alive, at least it clarifies things. When we talk about artificial intelligence and cyber wars and all the rest of that and all that fancy stuff, part of it includes weapons in space and the control of weapons in space and the capacity to shoot down other countries' satellites in space. I mean, this is really the next world war is going to be about who controls space. And who controls space is who has the most sophisticated, most capable, most reliable, best protected computer and space communication systems for destroying the other side. That seems to me to be uppermost in the military's mind as I read the tea leaves.
Well, it's also in Trump's mind. Trump just announced a week or so ago what he wants in future budgets. U.S. Budgets is the creation of a space force that's equivalent to the U.S. Air Force. That's the next big expenditure area in the defense budget, which keeps rising and rising here under Trump. It's going to go higher, which is going to exacerbate U.S. deficits and debt with the $5 trillion corporate business investor tax cut just passed and the planning more tax cuts for investors coming here this year. It's going to massively throw the U.S. budget and deficits and debt out of whack. I've been writing about that, too. We're looking at $1 trillion-plus deficits every year for the next decade under Trump.
This is your old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Bill Resnick for the Mo. I'm talking to Jack Rasmus. He writes and teaches on the international economy and politics. His latest book, Jack, why don't you announce the name of it?
Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression by Clarity Press, 2017.
Yeah, and he also is Systematic Fragility in the Global Economy. We've been talking about the phony war, all the sound and fury on tariffs and trade. Really, they have political objectives, one of which, of course, is to stop the Chinese effort to challenge the U.S. Power for World War IV, which is in space, on space weapons and the control of them and the control of space. Jack Rasmus began talking about the vast budget implications. Trump wants to set up a Navy, Air Force, Army, and then a Space Force, which could be 200, 300, and, well, even more, $1 billion in budget deficit. Jack, let's talk about the enormous imbalances in the U.S. economy now and what's likely to occur.
Well, what we got in Trump is a $5 trillion tax cut for investors and businesses. Not one and a half. It's $5 trillion made up by $2 trillion of it made up by imposing new taxes on the middle class, which leaves a $3 trillion net balance. They're saying $1.5 trillion because they're making ridiculous assumptions for the next 10 years of the U.S. economy growing 3.5% without a recession for 10 years in a row, which is impossible. Never happened. So you got $5 trillion in tax cuts, $3 trillion net hitting the deficit. At the same time, you got defense spending increasing by about $75 to $100 billion a year. So this is going to produce, even the banks like J.P. Morgan Chase predicting $1.2 trillion deficit this year. We're starting with a $21 trillion national debt, so we're adding $1 trillion every year or more if there's a recession for the next 10 years. We're going to end up 10 years from now with a total national debt of $30, $35 trillion. And the central bank, the Fed, is having to raise rates to pay for it. That's why rates are going up. Interest rates are going up. They have to finance that huge debt coming. And that huge increase in interest rates, as I predict, is going to precipitate the next recession.
And they have to raise interest rates to attract foreign money, right? You have
exactly,
to. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I mean, foreign money is almost half of all the financing of the budget deficit now. So they have to raise rates, but that's going to slow down the economy significantly at some point. And as I argued in Systemic Fragility, short-term Fed rates, which are the benchmark rates, everything follows, cannot go above 2.5% to 3%. And without precipitating another major financial contraction. And that compares, by the way, to 5.25% they went to in 2008. They can't go that high anymore because the U.S. added $20 trillion of debt on top of the crisis in 2008. And we're $70 trillion in debt now, and rates are going up. And this rising of rates is causing havoc throughout the capitalist global economy as well. Capital flight from emerging markets, slowing down growth in Japan and Europe. So we get some real contradictions in the global economy as a result of the central bank raising rates, which it has to in order to pay this deficit that Trump is creating because of tax cuts and defense spending. Well, this is the essence of neoliberalism, you know, but it may be reaching its extent. It may not be able to go much further because it's causing all the internal contradictions. But that's where we're headed here, and that's why I predict next year we will have the recession, 2019. The yield curves are predicting it. It's going to happen right after the elections or maybe a little later in next year, but it will happen. We will see a recession next year.
There's also a huge debt overhang, right? I mean, corporate debt is very high, even though they have vast amounts of money overseas. I'm not quite sure how that works. They're deeply in debt, and in a recession, they're going to have trouble getting enough money to pay off their debts. And then what you could get is a cascade of bankruptcies, and U.S. banks have been flying high and are now making a lot of speculative investments. We could get just a repeat of 2007 and 2008, but with a different trigger.
Well, actually, it's the same trigger. The trigger was interest rates going to 5.25%. But as I said, the economy is much more fragile now because of all the continuing debt accumulation, particularly on the business side. U.S. corporations for 6 years in a row have issued more than $1 trillion of new debt every year. That's why we get this $20 trillion debt increase. I'm not talking about the government debt, you know, which is at $21 trillion. I'm not even talking about household debt, which is higher than it was in 2007. I'm talking about mostly corporate debt. Well, why have they bought so much debt or issued so much corporate bonds and so forth debt? Because the interest rates were near zero for 7 years. And it was so much cheaper for them just to raise money by issuing bonds than it was to earn it. Central bank caused this problem.
They could use that money just by speculating in these super fast computer funds that keep buying and selling every less than every second, and they just keep accumulating right profits that way.
Or they used it for stock buybacks, which kept the stock market booming, right? Or dividend payouts to their shareholders, which also exceeded $1 trillion a year for 6 years. And now, with the extra tax cuts for these investors under Trump, they're buying back stocks and paying out dividends at $1.3 trillion this year. So you have this machine going of just creating all of this money and passing it through to stockholders and shareholders, buying up and boosting the stock markets and so forth. That's been going on for 6 years now, but it all comes down to the damn Federal Reserve, the central bank, causing this problem or exacerbating this problem. $1 trillion bond issues, $1 trillion payouts and stock buybacks.
But they have to do that to keep the economy going or else it lapses back into depression. Ultimately, it's going to fight back. Jack Rasmus, this pretty much ends this part of our discussion, your examination of the fragility of the international economy and the vast amount of money sloshing around and all seeking returns in various ways, creating more and more paper and instruments, all of which could lose value in ways that the whole thing came crashing down. In any event, that's the first part of our interview. And to tell us how we get more, your blog and what you do.
Right. Well, I write frequently here, you know, once or twice a week for various blog sources and so forth, Counterpunch, ZNet, so forth. But you can read all of my print reflections on current economic developments on my blog, jackrasmus.com. That's JACKRASMUS.com. And that will take you to my website as well. And all my books are there as well. You can read all kind of reviews of the books and select chapters for free that I put on my blog and my website. That will give interested listeners access to you know, my thinking in greater depth and detail, if they're so interested.
We'll sign off on that. So I just want to say, Jack Rasmus, thanks so much for talking to us.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host. I'm here with Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer. You just heard Bill Resnick and economist Jack Rasmus. They will return for part two, in which they discuss how deep economic decline can produce revolutionary movements and what can be done by the left. We'll have that coming up later in the program. Also later in the program, Fran Michel will discuss the work of controversial and notorious misogynist Jordan Peterson, who's speaking tonight in Portland. So Fran Michel, she's going to tell us a little bit about Jordan Peterson and somehow work in a discussion of lobsters as well.
Later today, Socialist Alternative and Democratic Socialists of America are sponsoring a rally to drown out Jordan Peterson. The Portland Peace Team will also be there, and so we hope will many others. At the Keller Fountain Park, Southwest 3rd Avenue in Portland, between Southwest Clay and Market Streets, at 6:30 p.m. Keller Fountain Park is across the street from Keller Auditorium, where Jordan Peterson will be speaking tonight. Peterson is a hugely popular champion of a certain fantasy of white, Western, male-dominated culture. He suggests that the goals of gender and sexual diversity and equality link to a Marxist project to destroy Western culture, or something. He proposes that patriarchy is natural and right because men are more competent than women are to run the world, a view that it seems to me might be easily disproved by simply taking a good look at the shape the world is currently in. Like Joseph Campbell or Robert Bly, Peterson takes old myths and stories as offering timeless truths about gender hierarchy and heroic individualism, and like them, he can do so because he ignores the vast numbers of stories and interpretations that don't fit his narrow paradigm. Like them, too, he appeals to a real need for meaning in the world, but he does so in ways that align with forces on the right wing. Several writers have noted that Peterson's status does not reflect well on the state of public intellectual life or on the coherence or savvy of the left, which should be offering more appealing alternatives. Peterson has a huge following on YouTube and Patreon, as well as a best-selling book titled 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, in which he argues that chaos is feminine, order is masculine, and people are like lobsters. Yeah, lobsters. Apparently, their territorial struggle to be at the top of the lobster hierarchy resembles the dominance conflicts in human society, where it's somehow inevitable and right that the strongest hoard most of the resources. Harrison Fluss in Jacobin notes that, quote, "Critics often mock Peterson for his comparison of lobsters and human beings. Echoing the worst features of 19th-century social Darwinism, Peterson uses this example of lobster hierarchy to analyze human society. He reduces class conflict to a natural and eternal struggle for existence that no political or economic revolution could ameliorate. The individual human, must develop an aggressive alpha male attitude in order to climb the social ladder. Peterson bases his worldview on one example from the animal kingdom, an example belied by other instances in which animals engage in mutual aid and cooperation." End quote. As Nathan Robinson suggests in Current Affairs, for a man to emulate a lobster is like a woman treating the existence of the praying mantis as a license to eat her husband's head off. For more about other kinds of animal behavior, see the work of Peter Kropotkin on mutual aid or the work of Joan Roughgarden on social selection in her book Evolution's Rainbow. Anyway, I confess I really want to mock the lobster thing, too. Maybe bringing in a reference to the lesbian moon lobster, that translucent pearl lobster caught and released off the coast of Maine last fall. Just do an internet search. Lesbian moon lobster. But maybe a better lobster reference here is the 2016 film by Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. Part of the Greek weird wave, it's a surreal, absurdist tale of a bizarre authoritarian world in which single people have 45 days to find a mate or else they'll be turned into an animal. The central character has chosen to be made into a lobster. But instead, he runs away from the singles hotel and joins the loners, only to find out that their group rules are just as draconian as those of the world of couples, only in reverse. Kenan Bezat Sharp, writing in Blindfield Journal, connects the film to the Greek debt crisis and the more general crisis of capitalism, pointing out that, quote, "We encounter the same logic of the double bind everywhere, from our intimate relationships and our debts to our electoral choices and political positions. The logic of the pseudo-choice, the false bind, the catch-22, is ubiquitous in our contemporary moment, from the Greek referendum to Brexit. Everywhere we turn, we are confronted with two, and only two, options. Yes or no, remain or leave, neoliberalism or neo-fascism, international capitalism or nationalist chauvinism, sociopath or psychopath, Clinton or Trump. Any attempt to reject this logic, to form a more complex position, to insist on nuance, to develop a plan B or C or D, is shouted down for supposedly giving strength to the enemy side. This is capitalist realism at its finest. And this is why The Lobster is a timely film, both for Greece and for the world. It's a cautionary tale, reminding us that both options spell only boredom and immiseration and death for those who are already most vulnerable. The dystopian nightmare The Lobster presents us with is one we already live in. We must wake up." End quote. In these chaotic times, we're asked to choose between unacceptable alternatives. Separate parents and children, or incarcerate whole families together indefinitely. No! We have to say no to those false choices and demand something different and better. The invitation to the event this evening reads, quote, "Fight back against patriarchy and transphobia. Join Socialist Alternative and the Democratic Socialists of America as we stand up against notorious misogynist Jordan Peterson, who will be spewing his hateful ideology on June 25th at the Keller Auditorium. Peterson is a Toronto-based professor infamous for his rejection of women's and trans equality. He also celebrates patriarchy as the quote-unquote natural order of society and wants us to revert to a time when women were subordinate to men and trans and non-binary gender identities were completely marginalized. Instead of going back to the gender norms of the 1950s, we should be creating a world where everyone is respected and everyone has their basic needs met. Let's show the world that Portland has no place for bigotry in any of its forms, and that we will stand together to fight for equality and dignity for all. Socialists say, an injury to one is an injury to all. Build a mass movement to fight patriarchy and gender-based oppression. Fight for the economic and social equality of women and other oppressed identities. Portland Peace Team will be marshaling this protest, ensuring that it stays peaceful and disciplined, with no direct confrontations with Peterson supporters." End quote. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michelle, inviting listeners to drown out Jordan Peterson this evening at 6:30 at the Keller Fountain Park, Southwest 3rd Avenue between Southwest Clay and Market.
The beach. Everybody had matching towels. Somebody went under a dock, and there they saw a rock. It wasn't a rock. Was a rock lobster.
Indeed. Well done, Fran Michelle, to somehow tie lobsters into this very important protest opportunity. Jordan Peterson tonight, downtown. Next up, we're going to go back to Bill Resnick and Jack Rasmus, who will be talking more about the economy and the economic decline that can produce some revolutionary movements and what can be done by the left.
Jack Rasmus, welcome again to KABU.
My pleasure to be here.
Jack Rasmus teaches at St. Mary's College. He was the economic advisor to the Green Party presidential candidate, Jill Stein. He blogs. He writes books. The latest book is Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. His previous book was Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Recently, he wrote a series of articles. The first one, it appeared in Z Magazine. The series is on the Trump administration. The first was called Trump's Phony Trade War. It's in Z Magazine, I think the May issue. Might have been the June issue. In the last interview we did with you, you predicted a coming contraction, you called it. Could be a deep recession. It could be even worse. It could become international. It's not clear that they can mutually all declare bankruptcy and start a new economic system going. That would be a negotiation, I think, even beyond the art of the deal, man. So, Jack, what should the left be doing? Deep recessions, and it's going to come. It just depends on when. It might, in fact, wait for a climate disaster, that disasters, many of them, that led to a huge spike in food prices. But there's going to be huge problems in this country in the next coming years. You think it's going to come pretty soon. It could come later. But what's the left to do? Disasters and capitalism don't often always go left. In fact, they can also go right, as they did in Germany, for example, prior to World War II, when Hitler managed to triumph in a terrible fascist victory in 1933. But in the United States, too, and around the world, we find right-wing parties prospering on the economic stresses and sense of fury of large sectors of the working class who have been both secluded and sort of derationalized over the last 30 years or more. Jack, you're the economic advisor for Jill Stein in her presidential campaign against Trump and Clinton. Tell us, what's to be done?
Well, when you talk about what the left's to do, it's a very broad question, and part of it is organizational lacking on the part of the left, and we can talk about that separately, but the other is, you know, what should the program be for a movement on the left? Well, you know, first of all, to answer that question, you know, what are the policies that are the source of this problem? And my forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, really looks at the evolution of these policies from Reagan to Trump here. And the theme of that is that, look, Trump is a restoration of neoliberal policies in more virulent, aggressive form, because the whole neoliberal regime almost collapsed under Obama here. So you got to see Trump as that even more aggressive, tax cutting for businesses, defense spending increases, attacking social programs, attacking trade allies. This is all part of, you know, industrial policy, deunionizing, holding down wages, cutting insurance benefits, holding down minimum wage. This is all neoliberalism, and it's crafted under Reagan here, actually in the last years of Carter, and it's been running wild ever since. It's behind why we have a financialization of a global economy. It's behind why we have so much income inequality going on. So how do you reverse that, right? Well, one of the key elements of neoliberalism is keeping interest rates through the central bank, alternatively very low, and then raising them when the crisis comes, right? Or they have to, the contradictions between low monetary policy, low interest rates, in other words, get too severe. Well, we saw under Obama near zero interest rates. Well, when you have near zero interest rates for 7 years, money is so cheap that money just keeps gushing into the economy, the global economy, the U.S. economy. And what I argue is that money didn't go into investing in real things in the United States to create real jobs and real incomes. Americans have been spending mostly by debt, borrowing even more rather than wage growth. So real investment did not occur. Where did all this money go? We're talking about trillions of dollars, at least $4, 5, 6 trillion injected by the central bank, the Federal Reserve, into the economy. Where did all that money go? Well, those banks and businesses that got the money either invested offshore, or they invested it in stock markets, or they invested in bond markets, or derivatives, or foreign exchange, and so forth. And they got, you know, super, super rich off of all this financial asset investing in speculation. You know, you see the stock market booming and so forth for years now. And as I said before, corporations are just passing this through to their shareholders in the form of $1 trillion every year in dividend and stock buybacks. 6 years in a row, $1 trillion. This year will be $1.3 trillion because Trump has given them another freebie of, you know, the big tax cut. So, you know, if you're going to stop this, you have to somehow deal with the central bank as a source of subsidizing banks and big business. That's what it is. That's its function, to bail out the banks and the system and subsidize it now. Just keep pumping the money into the system. So how do you do that? Well, the banks are pretty much still controlled. The Federal Reserve has always been controlled by the private banking system, indirectly now, but still nonetheless. And to change that, you're going to have to democratize the central bank. You're going to have to make the central bank's decision-making responsive to the public interest, not to the banker's interest. And at the end of my book, I talk about how this might be done, what kind of legislation and maybe even a constitutional amendment to democratize the central bank, because now it's just an appendage of the private banks and their friends in politicians in government. That has to change. What also has to change is that all this money that's being pumped into war and defense and in tax cuts, you know, $5 trillion tax cuts to investors and businesses here under Trump, not one and a half, $5 trillion, and they raise the taxes on the middle class to make up some of it, and they make some absurd assumptions of growth to make up the rest of it. And it's not just Trump. Under Obama, $6 trillion in extending the George W. Bush tax cuts and other tax cuts, and under Bush, about $4 to $5 trillion. So since 2000, we've been given $15 trillion to investors and corporations in tax cuts. At the same time, the defense budget has ballooned. It's closer to $1 trillion a year when you count not just the Pentagon, but the others, other sources where all this defense money is spent. So we have massive defense war spending and massive tax cuts creating massive budget deficits and a national debt of $21 trillion now under Trump will go to $33 trillion. You cannot continue that massive spending and tax cuts. That has to be reversed in terms of policy, both of those things. The whole policy of destroying unions, which they just about destroyed in the private sector, and now they're going after public workers, has to be stopped as well. And we have to generate real wage increases, not allowing consumption simply by households taking on more debt. You know, student debt is $1.3 trillion now, credit card debt's over $1 trillion, mortgage debt is several $1 trillion, auto debt is now over $1 trillion, households are up to their elbows in debt. It's not consumption based upon wage increases, it's consumption based upon debt and low-cost imports, you know. That's what's going on. That has to change. The whole neoliberal policy mix, it has to change, because all it's doing is enriching the 1%. That's its whole objective, you see.
Right.
And the central bank has to be democratized, and you have to reverse the defense spending and the tax cuts. And then you will have so much available funding to do everything else to really stimulate the economy.
Right. Let's talk about that, Jack. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Jack Rasmus about, we've been talking about policy, the policies that have to change, and one of them is the central bank has to stop subsidizing the rich and corporations and the banks, and the money that is put into the economy has to go into real things. And the other is we can't keep spending money on gold-plated military dreams, a huge subsidy to the, quote, defense industry, a huge industry employing millions of people. In any event, engineers as well, mathematicians, it goes on and on. Jack, let's talk about the sort of the politics of it. It seems to me, as you pointed out, the American people are up to their elbows in debt, and I think they're up to their chins in debt, actually, and are not going to be able to breathe really soon as the debt rises. The last election was an insurgency against both political parties. There's a tremendous amount of misgiving and worries and anxiety and anger amongst the fairly big majority of the United States right now. It seems to me that that we have to appeal to them. They're talking about the central bank is not going to... It makes sense as part of the discourse, but you have to talk about the real economy that they experience. And you did say that we have to raise wages. It seems to me we also have this climate change problem and various environmental problems and infrastructure problems that are killing people around the world and here. You were the advisor for the Jill Stein's presidential campaign. The centerpiece of her campaign was, in fact, although it included challenging the banks and the Federal Reserve, and certainly talked about ending poverty and raising wages, it also talked about a Green New Deal, which is, it seems to me, sort of a concrete idea of how we can change all of our production, and particularly the way we use energy and transportation and agriculture, to both create jobs and create a far healthier and deal with climate change to some extent if we do it internationally and if there's an international mobilization. It seems to me that that has to be part of the story if we're going to actually appeal to popular classes in the United States.
Well, you know, if you're going to mobilize people to resist Trump and resist neoliberalism and so forth, you have to appeal to their immediate interests. You know, when we talk about jobs, very important. Yes, they're creating jobs, but they're low-quality, low-paid, what's called contingent jobs. In other words, you make as part-time, temp, on-call, alternative work, gig work, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the millennials are stuck in this morass of poor quality jobs. That's an issue that has to be really driven home. It's not just jobs, but it's jobs you can live on and have a family on, which we're not generating anymore. That has to be the focus. And it has to be real wage increases and not shifting of the cost of benefits, which is going on as part of neoliberalism, to workers. You know, all of that real wage and job creation is really should be the central focus here. You know, real wages adjusted for inflation today for 111 million non-supervisory production and service workers, you know, 111 million of them, is lower today than it was in 1982. And there's been no increase. And that's not talking about the shifting of the cost for health care and the shifting of the cost for retirement onto the backs of these folks.
And of housing, God knows. Do you find the I was sort of suggesting that we have to talk about sort of the Green New Deal, that we have to set up we need good jobs, and the good jobs would be, many of them would be in infrastructure and greening of the economy and dealing with climate change.
That's a very important element, but it's not the only thing. It has to be there. It's absolutely essential, but it's not the only thing. We need a broader program. But more importantly, we need organization, you see. The problem with the left is that it's fragmented and fractured, or it's being sucked back into the Democratic Party. You know, this whole strategy of inside, outside, let's reform the Democratic Party, which is a chaotic waste of time. The money bags of the Democratic Party, the old Democratic Leadership Conference, which is now the faction that runs the party ever since Bill Clinton, is not going to allow any reform of that party. You can see what they've done to Sanders and are still doing to Sanders. What has to occur is all these real movements out there in the U.S., progressive movements of people who have legitimate concerns, those leaders of those movements have to come together. There has to be a kind of national congress where real leaders, real movements, not academics, not politicians declaring a party from top down, but a real movement of real people to come together to form an alternative political party and organization. Now, you know, the Greens could be a part of that. They could never lead it by themselves. But that conference, that Congress, has to come together of real people and form a real party that will contest for the real institutions of power in this country. In other words, the legislatures, the courts, you know, the executive roles and positions. That has to occur on the left. Because if it doesn't, like you said several times now, the better organized right, which already has a foothold in the institutions, will dominate and will prevail. You could see in the 2016 elections, and I predicted that Trump was going to win 6 months before, because he was appealing to those who free trade and the Obama and the neoliberal and Hillary Clinton policies were continuing to devastate. He won that election because he won several key swing states that Hillary never even bothered going to because she thought she had them wrapped up. That's how he prevailed and won that thin electoral college majority. And I predict that's what he was doing. He was going after the working classes and in those key states in the Midwest, just as the Conservative Party was going after the Brexit vote, you see. This is the phenomenon. The right wing has figured out how to leverage the nationalist appeal as an attack against the conditions created by the others, whether the others are other capitalists in other countries or people of color who are immigrants, you see. That's the strategy they put together, and it's working for them. On the left, we don't even have organization, let alone a strategy that really appeals to people who are being harmed by these neoliberal policies.
Jack, I guess we have to end, and we're going to end it there. Thanks. But I'm sure you agree, part of the process now is building up those movements that you see as
yes.
ultimately coming together in this Congress to build a new political force that will challenge our neoliberal establishment, Democratic and Republican.
That those movements are fragmented. Each are pursuing their own single issue. There's too much single issue politics going on the left. There's too much identity politics going on to the left, which is a diversion from uniting people on the real issues that are impacting their real lives, daily lives, economically. The left has to overcome this single issue identity focus and has to come together, and the leaders have to realize they can't be big fish in little ponds. They have to come together and be swimming all together in the ocean, you know?
I think we're closer to that maybe than you do. I think most of the, for example, women's organizations and certainly the Black Lives Matter, the various groups that came out of that, at least in their policy statements, they all now recognize that it's a systemic problem, that they have to come together, that jobs are vitally important, that changing the economy is vitally important, that creating a new foreign policy and domestic is important. At many levels of those organizations, some of them identity, some of them social justice, there's environmental justice organizations. I think we're moving that direction. At least I hope so. I'm sure you hope so. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Jack. Thank you for both halves of this interview, and looking forward to your new book. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Right. So long.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pyjamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as...
That is Monty Python doing money, following Bill Resnick and Jack Rasmus talking about the economy and money in some ways. Next up, though, we have our book mole, Larry Bolden, perhaps a lighter topic this morning, not without politics, of course, but Larry's going to talk about the novel Chemistry by Wai-Ki Wang. Larry?
The boy asked the girl a question. It is a question of marriage. Ask me again tomorrow, she says, and he says, that's not how this works. So begins the delightful and insightful little novel by Wai-Ki Wang entitled Chemistry. It is Wang's debut novel about a young woman working on a PhD in chemistry. Her boyfriend is also about to receive a PhD, and he proposes to her often, but is always put off until later. Besides loving the wacky story of this couple's courtship, I also relished the asides about academic writing, competition amongst grad students, and remarkable little facts about the universe we live in. Wang got her undergraduate degree in chemistry from Harvard, where she also earned a PhD in public health. Beyond that, she got an MFA from Boston University. She understands the politics of graduate education very well. Her narrator, whose name I don't think the reader ever is given, is at a standstill in her life. Besides pressure from her boyfriend to marry him and then accompany him to a Midwestern university where he will teach, she's also under constant pressure from her Chinese parents to finish her PhD and begin her career. But while she's always been an excellent and diligent student, she seems unable to come up with a creative idea for her dissertation, and so is also under pressure from her graduate advisor. Despite all the pressure, or because of it, she seems unable to move forward on any of these issues. She remarks that she has read somewhere that, quote, the average number of readers for a scientific paper is 0.6, with the clear implication that it is really not worth the effort to produce such papers. Quoting again, what use is this work in the long run, I ask myself in the room where I'm alone, the solvent room, officially, but I've renamed it the Fortress of Solitude, close quote. Unable to answer affirmatively to her boyfriend, but not wanting to leave the relationship, she makes up a list of pros and cons to help her decide, the making of such lists a lifelong habit of hers. Quote, the pros are extensive. Eric cooks dinner. Eric cooks great dinners. Eric hands me the toothbrush with toothpaste on it and sometimes even sticks it in my mouth. Eric takes out the trash, the recycling, waters all our plants because I can't seem to remember that they're living things. Close quote. Unlike the narrator, Eric sails through graduate school and is celebrated for his creative work, while she, in a fit of frustration, intentionally breaks a number of beakers in the lab and stops attending classes. quoting again, "It is common knowledge now that graduate students make close to nothing and that there are more PhD scientists in this country than there are jobs for them," close quote. Afraid to accept the marriage proposal, and even more afraid to tell her parents that she's abandoning her doctoral studies, she takes on students, tutoring them in math and chemistry, to eke out a living. The pressure from her parents is constant. She recalls how she was forbidden from attending social activities by her brilliant father. Quote, "I once had a math teacher who made me play a game. The teacher is my father, and the game involves a deck of cards. He sees no value in social dance. The rule is I cannot go anywhere until I have beaten him, and he knows I can't beat him," close quote. While this is sometimes uproariously funny book, there is a cutting edge of genuine sorrow and desperation that drives it. She sees her parents' marriage as one of constant fighting, and she cannot let herself marry given what she sees. Quoting once more from the book, "At some point my mother, probably to comfort me, tells me that there is no good marriage without constant fighting. Fighting is how a husband and wife talk. I pose a hypothetical to Eric. If I go with you, will you take the other question off the table?" That is the question of marriage. "Until when? Until forever?" He doesn't think so. Close quote. All in all, this is a funny and fine little novel, and the questions raised are more serious than I've made them appear. Also, the narrator is much more conflicted by and caring for her parents than I've made her appear. As she tries to find a way to reconcile both with her parents and Eric, she reminds herself, quote, "In Chinese, there is another phrase about love. It is not used for passionate love, but the love between family members. In translation, it means, I hurt for you," close quote. And she reminds herself that she hurts for her parents and for her devoted boyfriend. So she loves them after all. This is a beautiful little book, and it can be read in a single sitting. I've been talking about Wacky Wing's Chemistry. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And that closes our show for this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests and our engineer, Patricia Kohlberg. Reminder that you can drown out Jordan Peterson tonight at 6:30 p.m. Keller Fountain Park. That is Southwest 3rd Avenue downtown. 6:30, again, that's 6:30 tonight. And you can find The Old Mole and much more on KBOO.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour.